fix the Brazera to I'll get to it someday. Where experience, knowledge, and controversy share the same seat. Buckle up and hang on for the ride. Now for your host for No Driving Gloves, John and Derek.
So sit right back and we'll hear a tale of a fateful trip.
Yes.
Hi, everybody. It's No Driving Gloves, but we're talking boats in Gilligan's Island.
Was the Minot inboard? That's kind of automotive.
It could be outboard.
No, still. It was a large enough boat. It had to have been inboard.
It was probably like twin 409s or something, given the time period.
Yeah.
I would imagine it was a... I can't remember. We could look it up. I mean, we've got this Google thing in front of us. No, excuse me. We don't use Google anymore. We've got AI in front of us. It'll make up whatever the boat was.
Yeah.
We've got the truth doesn't matter. The internet.
You know, we were just lamenting that the internet has meant the death of the argument, because no longer do we go, well, I'm sure it was this, or, you know, logic dictates it was that. No, it's, well, we'll just look it up.
No, I find I spend a lot more time with people arguing over something, and we all go, oh, we could do this on our phone, and we continue to argue about it for another 5 or 10 minutes, and then somebody finally chimes in with what they found on the internet's interwebs.
Yeah, what's the
thank you Al Gore for the technology,
a series of tubes.
However, I think that this is a very fitting opening to the show, being that we're going to talk about factoids and all of that wonderful stuff that we decided to talk about tonight. So if everybody's noticing, I'm having technical issues. So some pop-up just came up. I had to close. So why don't we just start with it? I'm going to put a bet on the fact that I think the SS Minnow used a Mercury inboard engine. That's going to be my guess. What, Dave, what was yours?
Well, I said Chevy 409s, but I want to change that to AMC 327s. Gray Marine, hometown pride, Muskegon, Michigan.
All right, John, what do you got?
I believe it was a sailboat.
The Minnow?
Yes.
All right, now do we look it up or do we wait for
we're going to look it up.
Okay.
It certainly was not a sailboat, John. So you're immediately out.
That was Voyage of the Mimi.
Well, it goes according to the Google here, the SS Minnow from the TV show Gilligan's Island was powered by either a diesel or gas engine.
Wow. Steam is out.
According to what I found, it was a single 230 horsepower Detroit diesel engine.
Okay. There we go.
But the second SS Minnow from the movies was a 1964 Wheeler craft with two Detroit diesel engines.
Detroit diesels all over the place.
So they were Detroit diesels.
Yeah. And that'll spin right in, because somehow we're making continuity out of all of this. I've been listening to the book, and I'm forgetting the name. It's about Rudolph Diesel. It came out about a year ago. Fabulous, fabulous book. And all these little bits of trivia and stuff that keep popping up in it, and how he had his hands into this and partnerships here and partnerships there. And it's just kind of, to me, it's these little factoids we didn't know. And I wanted just to see what the three of us with our collective minds and worthless knowledge that's in there can actually spew and put out, throw out there. And if anybody in the chat rooms or YouTube or whatever want to throw in a comment, feel free. If you've got a factoid or want to tell us we're incorrect, which we never are.
Well, we can start with diesel, because it does have a history tied back to the automotive industry. One of the earliest automotive pioneers in the United States.
Winton.
Exactly. Detroit Diesel was GM's acquisition of the Winton Diesel Engine Company. So there's factoid for everyone.
They operated under that name for a while, I think, supplying early diesels to the U.S. Navy for submarines.
The United States Navy, yeah. The USS Cod that is stationed in Cleveland that you can actually go see is, if I recall correctly, operated by one of those wonderful diesel engines, or multiple probably of those diesel engines.
Actually, according to the book, it took years for the diesel motor to be adapted for surface ships, but it immediately basically created the submarine because it was the ideal engine for the submarine. And it was years later that they started putting it into surface ships.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah, surface ships were steam for a long time.
Right. Well, and it's funny because we shouldn't say the SS Minnow. We should say the MV Minnow because it's a motor vessel and not a steamship or
exactly.
screw steamer. Yeah. It's not as glamorous, though. Well, and Detroit Diesel's come up in. Are you guys familiar with the film Kelly's Heroes? It's a heist movie set during World War II. It's got Clint Eastwood, Telly Savalas, Donald Sutherland.
I saw amazing. That a long, long time ago.
I know Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, similar vein of comedy, that World War II satire, but a little darker than Hogan's Heroes. But anyway, at one point, they've got three Shermans, and they're trying to ambush a tiger in a village. And they go, well, we'll just sneak up there. And Donald Sutherland, who's playing the kind of proto-hippie tank commander, goes, oh, no, baby. They will hear our Detroit Diesels long before we get into that town, which is a cool line and was probably my first exposure to Detroit Diesel. But most American Shermans didn't use diesel engines. We sent those to the British and the Russians.
Well, actually, Nobel was huge in the Russian diesel front.
Nobel, the Swedish guy, the dynamite guy?
Yeah, he had a Russian company that basically handled the original licensing of the diesel engine in Russia. It's kind of weird. Diesel just threw, as soon as he proved the concept, he started to sell licenses and the money just started to roll into him. And it was, I can't think of the guy's first name, Bush, Augusta Bush.
Adolphus?
Adolphus Bush. He actually bought the first license for $1 million in 1886 or 1896 money to be the U.S. licensee of the diesel engine, which just it doesn't quite coordinate why the two. but
then we should point out that Rudolph actually never really saw much of the gains from the diesel engine because he went missing off of a ship he was on.
No, actually, by
jump or was intentionally taken out.
Well, by 1902, Rudolph was living in the wealthiest area of Munich and had built a house that would be the equivalent of, well, I believe it was $900,000 in his day. So he wasn't by the early 1900s. He was seeing income, but the diesel motor was not actually going the direction he wanted.
Yeah, he never saw the actual success and what could have been for him.
Yeah, yeah, he got it into ships and such, but he in 1912, he actually had job offers from Ford and somebody else to come and help develop the diesel engine in the U.S. And he said he was too busy, but he would look upon it in a few years. And he returned to Europe. And of course, early in 1913, like you said, died under mysterious circumstances. Well, he drowned. That wasn't the mystery. How he got off the boat's the mystery.
So is it true that the original diesel intent was to run it on straight vegetable oil, peanut oil, or is that a myth like the ethanol Model T?
According to the book, he wanted it to run on any kind of fuel, and primarily the coke developed from coal was one of his big sources. But he did have engines that ran on vegetable oil and peanut oil, and one of the first, if not the first, passenger ship without stacks or anything running on a diesel engine. I believe the first travel of it, they said, was peanut oil. So he had it running on all kinds of oils other than anything that was petroleum derived. And that's where we get the Rockefeller effect to him, that Rockefeller may have eliminated him. But as you listen to the book, diesel was playing every side of the fence. He was, you know, working with Russia. He's working with Germany. He's working with England. I always believe the Rockefeller theory, but the more I get into it, I believe he was taken out by a government because he was really playing Germany and England off of each other. and, you know, what Kaiser was in charge and what King was in charge, and where his feelings lie kind of weighed on in his finances. And to the point he had even said that he would consider becoming an American citizen and renouncing his German. He was nationalized to German. He was born in France, but he was never officially a French citizen because his father never declared where his father was. It gets real complicated, but this isn't a thing about Diesel. But like I said, that's what inspired me, because I can't remember in part of the book, they talk about Ford and Edison, and that how at one point in time, about 1906 or so, Edison and Ford, well, 03 to 06, Edison and Ford were working on an electric car. And that came to an abrupt halt when the almost 1 square mile of Edison buildings that were developing this car mysteriously burned to the ground. And it was thought to be arson, but Edison did not have it insured, nor did he have the $6 to $7 million to rebuild it. And at that point, the project was abandoned. Derek might know more on that topic than I, but
It's been a long time since I've read about it. But yeah, Edison did have a model. Oh, I can't remember what chassis it was.
It's an NRS frame, I think.
No, that's too, I think it was a AAC somewhere in there. Chassis that did, and then later on he actually had a Model T chassis that he put a lot of a battery pack in, and just the chassis battery pack
that was about 1914.
There's been a lot of mysterious circumstances around some of the projects that have occurred over time.
So somebody throw out a really interesting bit of trivia, because the other point that brought this up is today's September 26th, but on September 25th in whatever year is when Henry Ford created our 40-hour work week. And what was $5 a day was what the pay was? He gave all his workers the raise. And
yeah. $5.
Well, the ones that qualified.
Created the working world as we know it still to this day.
Which, you know, I don't know what rabbit hole we want to go down here tonight, but that's one thing that I really wish people would learn from history is, I see so many people commenting and things in different automotive groups that I follow on social media. Of course, yeah, take your information from social media, but the people like to post the whole, we got Henry Ford to blame for 40 hours a week and blah, blah, blah. And everybody seems to forget that before that, it was, 6-7 day work week, and you worked from sundown or sun up to sundown. And, Henry, although having many, many flaws, I am not saying that Henry Ford did not have flaws in his Fordism ideology, Taylorism ideology, and everything he did, but creating the 40-hour work week was actually a good thing for the American public in respect of where we had been prior to that.
Totally agree with you on that, Derek. And of course, part of Ford doing that was self-motivation by introducing this $5 a day wage and the 5-day work week. It allowed Saturdays. It's kind of how I live my life right now, but I allow Saturdays to go spend your money and Sundays to go to church. I go to the cigar shop, but go to church and be able to have your religious day. So in order for his workers to have time to go buy the cars they were producing, he had to give them a day off. And that, I think that was one of the original things. And I wouldn't be surprised if he had done some research and found out that a well-rested worker is better than a worker that's worked 80 hours and is falling into the assembly line, getting mulched by the machinery.
If you're interested in knowing the full story of that, the Robert Lacey biography's got a really excellent discussion about Henry Ford's philosophies going into that and how he essentially was part of the transcendentalist movement. You remember like Ralph Waldo Emerson and those guys, and a lot of things that he envisioned that would have been great kind of turned around the opposite. Like, you know, he really wanted everyone who lived in the city to be able to go into the country on the weekend instead of having everyone build suburbs in the country and then drive to the city in the week. But yeah. So, oh, I wanted to circle back to Diesel's real quick and just point out that Sir Harry Ricardo probably deserves a lot of the credit for the development of the high-speed diesel that we use in buses and cars and stuff today, because the original Rudolph diesel engines were pretty low RPM, which made them great for marine use, but not so good for road use because the engine speeds and didn't make for great flexible self-propelled vehicles.
I believe they started to introduce the diesel in, and I just read this fact a few minutes ago, post-World War II. They really weren't utilized as ground transportation. They were utilized, like you said, marines and for industry, because his original concept was he wanted to build small diesel motors for home shops and things, which ended up being replaced by electric motors, and the diesels became these big industrial things. But he originally envisioned them to help out people like his father, who I can't remember what small business his father ran, might have been leather work or something, but to help them in their businesses. And obviously the diesel went a completely different direction, and Thomas Edison, which supposedly Rudolph Diesel could not stand after meeting him, came up with the electric motor, or the electric motor and electricity, and I guess blame it on Benjamin Franklin. It took the place in the, you know, home shops. I mean, right now my 3D printer is running with electric motors. So do you see that if it was diesel?
Well, I mean, not a few generators are run off diesel. So we kind of have the best of both worlds in that respect, that you don't have to be on the grid in order to make use of electric motors, thanks in part to Rudolph Diesel.
Yeah, and I can't remember, they talked about, and it just gets to me, Derek and I have talked many times on this show, how nothing in the automotive world, and really nothing in the world, is a new idea. It's kind of like Hollywood. We just keep revamping old things, hoping to make it better. And everything, everywhere but Hollywood, we usually do. And there was something that was like an electric, I can't remember, something was electric but had a diesel generator with it. And that, you know, we're talking 1902, 1903 here. So the diesel generator would recharge the electric motor or something, or provide power for the electric motor, which I believe is what Dodge is doing right now in their new kind of hybrid pickup, that the motor is completely to charge it. And Chevy did with the Volt, and other vehicles are going that way, that they're having gasoline motors in them to basically keep the batteries charged.
Modern diesel locomotives operate on a similar series hybrid principle, with the diesel motor running the electric motors.
And we talked on a really, really early episode, because I always have been amazed that we haven't done that with RVs, big RVs, is a diesel motor to power electric motors on the wheels, just like the diesel locomotive.
Yeah. Well, they're built on big truck chassis. So
integrate the tech there. It seems like we could, because, you know, it's been proven in many ways, but also, you know, more recently in the automotive world, the Volkswagen XL1 prototyping work that was done, with the diesel electric hybrid of that nature in an automobile. And it was fairly successful at what it was trying to attempt. It was just very expensive.
My dad, who died 14 years ago now, was adamant that series hybrids should come to automobiles sooner rather than later. He said, I mean, he was a rail fan to begin with, and he was like, just makes sense. And I think it's just like so many things, it's a matter of scaling the technology down to a size where it fits in the chassis and is lightweight enough to use in a motor vehicle. I'm still waiting for my Ford nuclear car.
Oh, yeah, the
Atmos, I think. Oh, Nucleon, that's right.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking of the one from the 60s, the Nucleon.
I'm thinking of the one from the late 50s, where they didn't really specify
late 50s,
the huge reactor between the fins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To circle back to Detroit diesels, the big supercharger that sticks through the hood of all those street machines is patterned after the one that they used as an exhaust extractor on GM diesels back in the day. That's where the, you know, 271, 371, 471, 571 refers to the displacement of the diesel engine they were supposed to be used on, because it was 71 cubic inches per cylinder and then that many cylinders. So like a 671 blowers off a six-cylinder diesel with 71 cubic inches per cylinder.
That almost makes sense why they call it a blower. Because in a car application, it sucks air in, and that's not blowing. It's sucking it in and compressing it. But if you're using it on the exhaust, it's exhausting it, hence blowing it. So maybe that's a stretch, but that makes it sense.
And the Roots brothers, I mean, they were, they developed just an air pump for mine shafts. They didn't have any intention of using it on engines because the engines that existed in their day couldn't really make use of them. I think, what was the first supercharged car, Derek? Was like a Chadwick or something? Or was it the Mitchell? This would be like 1904, 1906.
Chadwick sounds right. I don't remember Mitchell doing it. I think Chadwick was right. And then it quickly made its way into Indy racing. And
yeah, I mean, it's especially when you're dealing with like flathead engines and primitive combustion chamber technology, it's one of the most efficient ways to get more air into an engine. So, you know, yeah, they've got some parasitic loss, but blowers, if you can justify the cost and the complexity, they're great power adders.
Well, I was going to throw in while you were talking about Ford, did you hear what anti-technology Ford did this week?
Anti-technology?
Yeah.
What?
They announced they are no longer going to offer self-parking in any of their vehicles. You will now have to manually park your car. You cannot have the car do it itself.
Let me guess. People were charging, you're sending the bill to Ford when they hit them.
No reason given, but maybe Ford decided people need to learn to drive. Just thought it was an interesting thing that, you know, Ford, you know, has recalled their patent on self-repossessing cars. They've recalled their self-parking cars. They're kind of taking away a lot of the self stuff out of the cars and putting it back on the human.
Good.
I like
to drive.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, I guess, you know, if we were to apply all of this to like mass transportation for the people that don't want to drive, go ahead. But I think in the automobile itself, the individually owned automobile, if you want to own an automobile, then drive an automobile. Don't rely on it just being a pod that takes you places. If you want that, then, you know, use the automated pod of mass transportation, you know, buses and things like that, that are going to be running, you know, autonomously and all of that. That'd be my take on it.
Well, it's the mass part that turns people off. We're all frustrated Vanderbilts and Rockefellers. They got to have a private train car. So, you know, we just want to get in our Pullman and open the newspaper and let it drive us to work where we can go and make our millions and then it can chauffeur us home. But yeah, no, I would love to see people who don't want to drive on the bus. That would be ideal from my perspective. And there are times when I'd like to take the bus. You want to cut down on drunk driving? Get people on the bus. What happened to my mason jar? It's just right here.
There it is. Yeah, it's actually a mason jar this week. Normally it's like a growler.
It's a kombucha jug normally. Yeah.
There you go.
But with only water in it. No floaters for me. I don't know exactly what kombucha is, but I just want the jug. I like the water.
Still doing the Diet Dew in the No Driving Gloves cup, which we're going to be doing a production run of shirts and cups and stuff in October. So let me know if you're interested. And yes, Robert, you on the list.
Speaking of shocking facts that the other hosts didn't know, we're doing a production run of cups and shirts.
Well, I have a bunch of vacation time I got to take by the end of October. So I'm working 3-day weeks for the entire month of October.
Wow. So. Happy Halloween to you.
Yeah.
Now, Jason just brought something up that I can bring a shocking fact into. He said no white lightning in the mason jar to Dave. And interestingly, the name White Lightning for moonshine, which, of course, was run illegally in automobiles, the beginning of NASCAR, right? The name White Lightning, a lot of people wonder where that comes from. And it actually comes from the jars that they typically preferred to put it in, which actually technically would not have been mason jars. They were strictly canning jars. Mason's patent was on the threads for the lid of sealing the jar. Prior to that, there were all kinds of seals, and there happened to be one sealing technology that was called a lightning bail because of how fast how quickly you could open the jar. And so when moonshiners started running it, they would put it in lightning bale top jars, because if they felt they were going to be caught by the law, it was the quickest one to open and dump all of them out before getting caught. That's where the name white light comes from.
I did not know that. That's a cool factoid.
Yeah. of course, you guys know my lovely wife, Christine, collects canning jars, historic canning. We have a large collection. That's her hobby. And we have a few, a number of lightning bale and lightning brand jars in the collection.
Some originally sealed from the late 40s and early 50s.
I wish.
So are you perfecting your moonshine recipe now?
No. I got other things to do. Many, many other things to do.
I just, because it can be used as a motor fuel too if we purify it enough.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the books that my computer is sitting on here is called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, that I picked up specifically because it's got instructions on how to modify carburetors for E85 and E100 fuels, because I don't know. I have this idea that making your own fuel at home would be cool.
Well, just make a biodiesel.
Yeah, I like spark ignition engines.
Oh,
I don't want a compression ignition engine. Sorry.
You're going to get picky.
Well, yeah, that's why I do all this stuff, is because I am picky. Otherwise, I'd just drive a Camry or something.
Yeah, well, in that case, I prefer open flame ignition, okay? So,
is that a steam car thing?
No. Open flame ignition it was really used only on stationary engines. But that's where you actually have a flame burning outside of the cylinder. And as the engine is running at the appropriate time, a valve opens, much like the intake valve, but a sliding, like a slide valve opens and actually sucks the flame in, igniting the air-fuel mixture, and then closes again. And of course, the flame relights on the outside.
Oh, I used to start my Camaro that way sometimes when it would backfire through the carb. You just take your foot off the gas and crank it over, and it just boom. Yeah.
In the book I'm reading, one of Diesel's future projects, he believed it would only produce at the time 2 to 4 horsepower, but he had a concept of a solar ignition where you would utilize heat from the sun to heat the cylinder and cause the spark cause enough heat for the combustion. So he was using air in the diesel engine to compress air, and the heat of that lit it. But instead, he was looking at a way to heat the cylinder chamber so that it would get hot enough that would actually ignite and be, quote, your spark or whatever. Really. Guy had to be brilliant, but
I mean, I guess I could see that if it was a stationary engine, you could have a magnifying glass that could either, be an entire glass that followed the sun or, was moved periodically, that would focus the beam of light onto like a hot tube type setup, heating the tube that would then act as your ignition source. I could see that. It just seems very difficult to make sure that it's always in focus as the sun moves to get the heat that you would need.
Well, I mean, if you look at solar panels, if you had a large enough whatever he was going to use to gather the solar rays, those get extremely hot. And if you kind of made the head out of something similar to that, that could contain the explosion, which from what I understand, the first time they fired off a diesel motor, the explosion was something to be legendary as the thing self-destructed. The insides of the motor wanted to see the outside world again, as they say.
Old 350 diesel? What?
Knock, knock. Who's there? Number 3.
So that, it kind of points out what a big deal the spark plug was when they finally figured that out. Using their dental porcelain and such things, because getting something like that was heat resistant, wouldn't blow out of the cylinder head, and would reliably produce spark was huge. That's why guys like Albert Champion made big fortunes doing that kind of thing. It's also the French influence on ignition is why spark plugs went metric long before other car parts. Like already by the early 30s, they're using millimeter size plugs and everything instead of pipe thread like they were in the 20s and earlier.
Pipe thread is cool. And actually, you know, interesting maybe factoid. I think we've covered it on the show many, many years ago. So most of our listeners are either new or have forgotten what we say 5 minutes after they listen to us. But Dave brings up the French influence on ignition. And that can actually be backed up to the term chauffeur, which originally did not mean the person who drives the vehicle. Chauffeur, and I don't speak French well, so I would probably pronounce these words incorrectly. But the root of chauffeur is, I believe it's just chauffe. Again, I don't speak French, but it actually means to heat. And where the term chauffeur came from was you would actually chauffeur the car in the early days. So the you know, basically the caretaker for the automobiles in a wealthy family in France, when the family wanted to go somewhere, especially with hot tube ignition, they would have to chauffeur the car or get the hot tube flames lit and get them hot enough so that the car would start and run. And that was actually chauffeuring the car. That was to actually get it heated up, get the ignition ready, and be able to start it to be able to take the family to town or wherever they wanted to go. That's actually where that term comes from.
That's interesting. I mean, it makes sense, like almost like firemen, essentially. It's amazing what leaders the French were before the First World War in technology. I mean, cars, airplanes. Yeah. The carburetor, French word, means carbon mixer, right? You know?
Automobile.
Automobile, the French term.
Yeah. And let's wrap it back to Alexander Winton. The first time it was heavily used, the term automobile was heavily used in the United States, was when Alexander Winton drove from Cleveland to New York. And he and I used to know the guy's name, the journalist from the Plain Dealer there in Cleveland. I'm completely blanking
on his name. Charles Brady King?
No, Charles King was from Detroit. First automobile in Detroit. But anyway, he and Winton, when they wrote the articles and wired them back, decided to use the term automobile rather than horseless carriage.
Their editor would have preferred they use car because it would have taken up less space and less type, which was why so many American words are shortened.
They weren't as stingy as automotive journalists are today.
Oh, the newspapers were they started all of that stuff. Come on, man.
Would have that been, just out of curiosity, Dave, would have that been to take up less space so you could get more words? Or would it because we were using manual typeset in the beginning and each letter had to be placed to, you know, on the press? And it would be quicker and easier to set the type rather than actually the space in the paper or journal.
Yeah, both. I mean, it does give you room for more information, but it's primarily a cost savings thing, is my understanding.
We don't care about getting information out. We care about selling papers.
Well, that's, yeah, okay.
I think we had a conversation offline about that this week.
Yeah, that is the gist of some things in our society, isn't it?
Well, Jason Hill comments that this is when driving gloves would be practical.
Is that driving from Cleveland to New York City with Alexander Winton and a journalist with no name? This is kind of sounding like a Gonzo Hunter S. Thompson sort of thing. Like the Winton had just hit 35 when the bats came out.
Hey, I will say I do always wear leather gloves when I start the Benz Patton Motorwagen. I take them off to drive it, but I've come close to hurting myself pretty bad with the Benz Patton Motorwagen when it kicks back. So.
I remember it starting backwards on you once.
It likes to kick. They like to kick backwards once in a while. That's why you always wait for the flywheel to stop moving before you grab it again. Because if it does decide to go backwards and you're grabbing it, your thumb can go the wrong way. So much like hand cranking your car.
Just out of curiosity, if it starts and runs backwards, does that just mean you can get in and drive it, but the gears are reversed in the transmission?
It can't. It's a four stroke. So it can't run backwards. Two strokes, however, can. And I've seen a number of two-stroke cars start backwards and people jump in and put it in first, and all of a sudden they're backing up. And they don't quite realize back through the Denny's. Yeah.
There's your new excuse for unintended acceleration for the lady in the convenience store. Motor drives to run backwards, and I put it in drive and backed into the building.
I'm sorry. All I have is this antique Saab that I get around in.
Yeah. It's one of the things I'm looking forward to with the bug yacht is, seeing it start backwards and have the fun of all of a sudden going backwards one day.
I got my Corvair back on the road this week. Did I tell you guys that?
Is it running and driving, or did you just push it out to the road?
I just pushed it out, and it's running and driving. I had taken it off the road because the front suspension had started shrieking and the brakes didn't work so hot and the exhaust had fallen apart. So I was like, I got a few things to do here. And then I proceeded to work all summer and travel and never touch it. It just sat on skates in my garage. And finally, I went to our shop manager, Junior Nevison, and I said, how would you feel about looking at this thing with me and seeing how much it needs? Because, you know, I have about the mechanical skills of like a 50s teenager, which is, you know, more than the average 42-year-old guy in our society, but not what you would consider like ace mechanic. So having Junior there with all of his experience and improv skills was a real treat. So he just went right through it, and he had me move the steering wheel, and he goes, oh, here's your problem. The bushing on the pitman arm had been installed 98% of the way. So it wasn't actually preventing metal on metal, and it just so we managed to use a wheel puller to lever it in the rest of the way, and so now it's smooth as silk. And one of my brake adjusters was frozen from rust. We broke it free and got everything adjusted properly, and I had managed to accumulate both an NORS head pipe and an NOS muffler and tailpipe at various swap meets and through friends for my Corvair. So now it's quiet and it sears right and it stops, and I feel like I can let my 17-year-old actually drive it for once.
Nice. So,
which is good too, because then our truck immediately broke. So it's the only functioning vehicle in the household right now, because the cab
isn't that the way shot. Shows you get something fixed and something else breaks. It just
I would really like to not be in that situation anymore, because my wife is very tired of going, which of these vehicles is going to break on us? How next?
Really
only I should be driving the interesting old car, and the rest of the household needs boring transportation, but I'm getting there. I have a deplorable excess of personality sometimes, as they put it in Jurassic Park.
Well, the good news on my end is that, of course, in about, is it 2.5 weeks or so from now, is the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And the 1958 Lloyd, affectionately known simply as Lloyd, the Sport Custom or Sport Roadster or whatever you want to call it, that I have, is nearly ready to go to the show to be in the Sport Custom class that's going to be hosted there. So I got the new shoes on it today. And
white walls? No,
that would look hideous on this car.
It's from the 50s. I can't imagine that being the case. Everything from the 50s looks good with white walls, even if it is German. Okay.
Well, it's German because it's a Lloyd chassis, but the custom body is done in Canada by a shop somewhere in Canada using Packard sheet metal from the early 50s. So
I'm not hearing a strong case against wide white walls from anything you just said.
Well, I'll send you a picture of it again and really think about whether white walls would look right or not.
Jason asked about Brooklyn's windshields, and I'm into that. I love Brooklyn's. That's like my favorite windshield.
I am still hoping to. I'm really struggling with my decision on where to take the car, because it's mostly original. It's the original paint. It's all original customization. So, the windshield that is on it, literally 6 bolts and it comes off. So it wouldn't be hard to switch it back and forth to the Brooklyn screens. So I'm still debating. I'm just having a hard time being who I am, making modifications to something that's pretty well preserved and has some history behind it. So we'll get there.
Well, you should do what's commonly done on a lot of sports racing cars, where you can have the windshield and the Brooklyn screens mounted just behind it, so that you can have the Brooklyn screen when you're going to race it. You take the windshield off and the screen's there. And when you're going to drive it on the road, you put the screen back on, because I've driven Lotus 7s. Well, then you put the Brooklyn screen in front of the windshield. But I've driven enough Lotus 7s with Brooklyn screens. If you ever want to drive a damn thing on the road, you don't want a Brooklyn screen. Looks cool, but
that's why you wear goggles.
It's still the rock to the forehead that hurts.
Or the teeth. That's why the dirt track cars have no windshields, but they've got like chicken wire mesh in the
windshield
area. Yeah. Yeah.
Although a lot of the early race cars didn't even have that. They were just open. Nobody cared.
Oh, yeah. That was 50s and later thing.
Race car drivers, they're disposable.
Not as disposable as riding mechanics.
The monkey on a sidecar racer.
I always enjoyed being the riding mechanic.
Well, that's because you're used to gentlemanly racing and not like blood, smoke, and death in, 1911.
Those were most of the cars I was riding.
Right, but they don't treat them like they did that back then, is my point.
That's true. I have portrayed the Spider Huff position on sweepstakes at about 65 mile an hour. So
okay, that's pretty hardcore. Yeah.
Yeah.
My grandfather's nickname in college was Spider.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he was a basketball center. It was pretty not automotive.
So your grandpa's nickname in college or high school?
College. He was a basketball player for Grinnell.
Was Spider.
Spider.
And you wound up with the nickname DW.
Only with you, pal.
And now I'm trying to send Dave and John more pictures to refresh their memory of the Lloyd.
I'm digging the Brooklyn screens idea, though, especially with the black walls. I mean, black walls suggest a competitive edge here, so we've got to live up to that. It's like a Crosley, like a hot shot.
Exactly. So yeah. I just sent the picture, Dave, so you can refresh your memory.
All right. It hasn't shown up yet, but that's...
And say my phone dunged, so it proves you sent it.
Oh, I had it on Do Not Disturb, so I wouldn't be making obnoxious sounds through the course of our podcast. See, I think that's a lovely little car and would look great with Brooklyn screens occasionally swapped out for that piece. But yeah, okay, I understand on the white walls how you would prefer. Although they would set off that light-colored interior.
No, the white walls would be... The white walls would look good because it would... it's the dark green with black tires and the little, hubcaps. White walls with a set of spinners, he'd be set.
Spinners, man. Now we're really getting 50s. Couple dual antennas with streamers off the back.
Some curb feelers on it.
Curb feelers.
Well, it wasn't customized until the early 60s. So.
Oh, so we need red lines.
Chassis.
Skinny white walls or red lines. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just see lots of good possibilities here. And then are we going to take this out to a vintage sports car Club of America meet eventually, like Lime Rock?
I've actually already talked to the VSCCA, and they will accept the Lloyd and the Hupmobile into the club. So I do plan on joining within, hopefully the next year or so. And actually, I really want to hill climb the Lloyd because it's a completely front engine. It is true front engine, i.e. in front of the front axles. So front engine, front wheel drive. So
it's like racing a chariot.
Yeah, basically it doesn't matter where the rear end is. I just keep going.
Ice racing.
Ooh, that's
studded
a good idea.
Tires, front wheel drive.
Yeah. Ice racing is becoming big again. I know some people that are participating in it.
Yeah, I have a friend up here that does it, but there hasn't been good ice for it in many years at this point. So we might have to go back to Canada with your Canadian Lloyd to find ice to race on. It.
Whatever happened to that law that Australia passed that you couldn't export any antique car or motorcycle in Australia? You were not allowed to export out of Australia. Does that law still exist? Do either one of you even know or heard of that?
Was unaware of that. I know India has a law like that.
I will say I don't think that applies to Australia anymore because I know a friend of mine who bought an Overland out of Australia and it is now here in the US.
So, because that, I know when it passed or came into effect shortly thereafter, like RM or somebody sold a Brough Superior for, you know, $100,000+ to an American buyer. And the big controversy was, well, he could never take it out of Australia. So I assume somebody.
So his lobbyists took care of that.
Jason suggesting you do Pike's Peak with the Lloyd, except you'd probably get killed by the car that came up the hill after you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because not only would the three cars behind me pass me on the way up or shove me off the cliff, I'd have to stop probably two times on the way up to adjust the carburetor to different elevations.
I would really like to do Mount Washington, but that's the coming actually, down that scares me.
Mount Washington is one that I want to do with the Lloyd, as well as what is the other big one up your way?
Equinox?
Yes, Mount Equinox, hill climb. Yeah. I really want to do Mount Equinox run.
Yeah, and I was supposed to go to the Vintage Sports Car Club of America Equinox thing last summer, and I think somebody got sick at the last minute and I didn't make it. I was bummer for me because it looks cool.
Isn't it relatively close to you?
Yeah, it's actually up just up past Manchester a little bit, like maybe 45 minutes away. It's stupid.
I was gonna say about an hour or so.
Yeah.
So that's what I need to do. I need to get Lloyd ready, do the VSCCA stuff. I just haul it up to your place and we go have some fun.
Yes. I'm into having fun with old cars wherever I am. So bring it on.
You know, Jason said doing Pike's Peak downhill. That would be interesting just to do the whole event instead of racing up the hill. What about racing down the hill?
Sponsored by Brembo.
I was going to say, I have a feeling there will be a lot more rocks off the cliffs if you race downhill on Pike's Peak.
Notice there how the centers of his front wheels are glowing as he attempts to scrub off speed coming into this corner.
It would be interesting, though.
Oh, yeah. No, I'd pay to watch that. I mean, that's like I would watch stock car racing if they literally just issue these guys a bunch of mid-sized cars right off the showroom floor with a cage. Like, yeah, we took the carpet out and we taped up the headlights and there's a cage. So go get them, boys.
Well, yeah, let's go old school.
Up out at 110 miles an hour. Well, that's what the rest of us drive, pal. It's stock car racing now.
Welcome back to NASCAR.
Do you think somebody could get away with starting a series like that? I mean, if you think of the popularity of Chump Car and whatever it is, the $500 racing league, and which cost you about $5,000 to build a car for, but just literally, it has to be something off the showroom floor. With you could remove the carpets and maybe the passenger seat. Everything else has to stay, and a cage put in it. I think they could get.
I mean, in a sense, what you're describing there is like IMSA racing, but of course they use sports cars. But I mean, there's nothing that says you couldn't do it with much cheaper, more pedestrian cars. The only problem you might find is that NASCAR would probably do everything in its power to quash a similar competitive racing series if it became a real threat to their media empire, which is not doing so anyway, as far as I understand.
You'd keep them gas powered, so you wouldn't be stepping on NASCAR's future electric plans. So,
I mean, I would certainly give it a watch. I mean, that was also what I liked about rally racing is, you know, it was what looked like factory type cars racing down public roads. They were closed public roads, but like, let's see what these cars can do on these roads instead of putting homogenized nonsense on a peaked or on a banked oval and watching it go around like an electric train. Like,
yeah, but we like eventually in that evolved into, you know, complete race cars with sequential shifters and everything. And, you know, IMSA's not IMSA anymore. I mean, everything's custom bodied and they're not, showroom cars. I guess if you want to go back, the Lotus X180R I restored from 91 or so, that's pretty much a stock Lotus Esprit with some little tweaks. But the interior, I mean, still was the center console and the dash and that were straight out of an Esprit. I believe the driver's seat was custom. It was still a race seat, but it even had door carts, so.
Nice. Yeah, that's the type of race car that appeals to me. You know, you can keep your 300 mile an hour streamliners or your 7-second top fuelers and all of this stuff because they don't even seem like cars.
you know, and that stuff doesn't, with what we talked about last week and that Porsche racing the McMurray or whatever it is, what's drag racing? What happens when we start seriously putting electric into drag racing? And we're, you know, 7 second quarter miles.
Did you see the video of the electric drag rail car that just set a world record?
No, like I've missed weeks. That.
It is insane.
Do you guys remember the white zombie Datsun? Like that was before everybody was into electric cars, and just this old Z car, 280Z or something with an electric motor in it, going out in a humiliating big block Camaros and stuff on the drag strip because instant zero RPM torque. And there's no range anxiety when you're only going a quarter mile.
That's true.
That might be a good topic to come up with is, what is going to be the new performance? 0 to 60 is out. Top speed, I mean, 300 miles an hour. You can only do that in about 6 places on the planet. You know, do we get back to my favorite road racing and see how quickly you can go right and left? But when you have 4 electric motors controlling power to each wheel, and I mean, what is going to be performance? Or do we just all go back to low riders and cool custom paint jobs?
It's the NVH ratings of your self-propelled electric pod.
Yeah, maybe that's it. The instead of 0 to 60, it's how far can you go at full throttle? Yeah,
which like Tesla, the old days.
Which Tesla Model S Plaid can go the farthest?
Well, nobody's going to beat the one that's in space.
That's a roadster. In space, I read an article within the last year talking about what condition that car is in, and pretty much that journalist felt it doesn't exist anymore.
Wow. It
basically is disintegrated.
It would be hilarious if it hit a Starlink.
We've all seen the video that it's all fake. It was in a studio, and the car was hanging out in that studio. Huh?
That's the moon landing, Derek. That was faked in a studio.
No, I know that was. Thing happened. No. There's video out there. The Tesla launch is fake, and that car is not in space.
Stanley Kubrick is dead. He wasn't around to do the Tesla thing, just the moon landing. And on that note,
well, carry the conversation for a moment. I've got to see. No, I can't pull it up, Jason. I'll have to show it next week.
I want to see this racing poster. I'm excited.
Yeah, I don't think I can get it pulled up because I'd have to start a whole nother computer to get it up.
Well, yeah, and I'd have to actually, Jason, if you send it to me, I will then text it to the guys.
Well, I can text it to the guys.
The barn, so.
I don't know. Does that show up at all on the camera?
No, because it's like green screen.
Trippy kind of. I got the gist of it though, which I liked.
It's a very cool. Jason has been very awesome in doing some cool artwork for me. And created a very cool. I used to live not far from Nelson Ledge's racetrack when I lived in Ohio, and so he created a really cool vintage racing poster with the Lloyd racing at Nelson Ledge's on a fake 4th of July weekend race, because I acquired the car on 4th of July weekend, so out of Ohio. So
that's outstanding. And do you have a reproduction of this on the wall?
The poster?
Yeah.
Yeah. He sent me the poster. Yeah.
Sweet.
Hang on. I think I just about have it.
John is thrashing.
Jason just sent it to me.
Someone has a very urgent text message sound. Breaking news.
Oh, that's the way I roll. Dave.
You should have it in just a moment.
Oh, and there it is. Oh, that is great. Good work, Jason. I like that.
For those of you out there in video land, hopefully I get here in just a second.
Derek looks far too casual, though. I mean, I think he'd be more like elbows in tension going around that corner.
Nah, I'm pretty laid back.
You're that chill when you're out there wrangling your one-of-a-kind front-wheel drive.
There we go.
Germano-Canadian.
Hey, look at that. We can show it on the big screen.
Nice.
Hopefully we have Jason's permission to publish that.
Well, his comment is he was bored one day, and this is what he does when he's bored. So imagine what he does when he actually puts his mind to something.
He usually ends up buying some V8 car from something, or I did stumble across an 04 Gallardo for you, Jason. It was pretty cheap on Facebook Marketplace. 04 is the worst year to buy, but
that's why it's cheap.
You know, that reminds me of the one trivia thing I didn't get to tonight, which was, what was the first Chevrolet V8? I'll bet Derek knows this off the top of his head. Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah.
The 1917 Model D. What I learned in the course of refreshing myself on that, though, was that the Oldsmobile and Oakland V8s were apparently related to the Cadillac Series 51 V8.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The Olds were different. Right. They were not. Of course, Chevy's V8 was the overhead valve system.
Yeah.
Much a very cool engine. There are only a handful in existence. And I've had the opportunity to see one in person, and it's absolutely fascinating.
And I learned that there were two body styles, right? A chummy roadster and a true touring car. What did you see?
The one I've seen is a chummy, is the roadster. Yeah.
Okay. I've seen videos.
You can find videos of one of the touring cars that still exists on YouTube.
That's very cool. And then the Olds, the Oakland, and the Cadillac flathead V8 are all the same engine. Not the same as the Chevy engine, but the same as one another. The North.
Right. Way. Same basic engineering principles, different sizes, right? Different cubic inches, things like that. But yeah, they're the same platform, let's call it.
That's pretty cool. And then in 1923, they made the first outing of the GM Supersport badge with the 1923 Oldsmobile Supersport V8 touring car. An Olds with a flathead V8 called a Supersport.
Heck yeah.
There's one of those in the Nicola Bulgari, the NB collection in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Mr. B. That car's,
he's got good taste, man. I love those middle market cars that he's collected.
I have stories from the NB Center.
I'll inquire upon those soon. I'm very curious.
It's a great place. So I think that brings us to just over the hour mark. So unless anyone else, John, Dave, if you guys have any other shocking factoidal tidbits to lay out, I think we can probably wrap the show up.
Well, we compressed a lot of information into this episode.
I think so. Joke.
Oh,
man, I missed that. That was a good dad joke, and I missed it. Dang.
He who laughs last thinks slowest. Yeah.
Man.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
All right. Well, seeing Dave and John have nothing left to say, as, you know, is not normal. Guys, thanks for listening again tonight, joining us on the Thursday night live stream. As always, if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy listening to us banter back and forth and being part of the No Driving Gloves community, make sure you do some favors for us. Either number one, go ahead and you know, click on the QR code, buy us a coffee, 2, 3, 100, whatever you want to do. Make sure you follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, all those great places. Also, make sure you click that little bell on the YouTube notification so you know when we're going live and when new episodes drop and all that wonderful stuff. And of course, as we always say here at No Driving Gloves, if you guys enjoy the show, if you enjoy learning all of these weird little tidbits of information that we have to share with you, there is one thing you can do to make the show bigger and make the No Driving Gloves community grow. And that is, as I like to say, help us grow, share the show.
Thank you, everyone, for the... Yes, Dave never says goodbye.
Goodbye.
This show was a part of the No Driving Gloves Network, produced and edited by John Viviani of Magic City Podcast, with voice work by Gary Conger. So until the next time...